Hi, this is Tony Alessandra. Wayne and I have shared the platform on three continents, and I can say wholeheartedly that he is one of the most genuine individuals I have ever met. Wayne lives what he teaches. He embodies the principles he preaches, and he has an amazing ability to convey his values to others so that they can get a sense of the peace, understanding, and enlightenment that are so important and yet sometimes so elusive. Wayne's work has influenced the thinking of many of today's top speakers, trainers, and authors, including myself. I focus on building strong interpersonal relationships for life, both in business and personally. If a person has low self-esteem or isn't true to their own inner being, it's difficult for them to have healthy relationships with others. Wayne teaches us how to believe in ourselves. Wayne truly has a gift for showing others how to make their own lives better, whether it's emotionally, spiritually, or psychologically. And you can't help but come away from an encounter with him a better person. Listen to Wayne Dyer and watch your life and your relationships flourish.
Volume 9, Building Loving Relationships.
I recently appeared down in Australia with one of my friends, John Gray, who wrote Men Are From Mars and Women Are From Venus, and he's got us on different planets and all of this, and he's a wonderful guy. We had a great time down there. And I was asked to talk about relationships and to write an article. So I wrote an article that I really liked. I called it, Your Soulmate is the Person You Can't Stand. And everybody thought, wow, what kind of a crazy thing is that to say? Because most people, when they talk about they're looking for their soulmate, you know, I finally found my soulmate, and we think alike, and we act alike, and we both like green, and asparagus is our favorite vegetable, and he goes to say something, and before he can even say it, I say it already. Oh my God, we think the same thoughts, and we get up early in the morning, and we both like to meditate, and we both like yoga, and we both eat mushrooms, and we eat them the same way, and he cuts the stems off the same way I cut the stems off. It's just amazing. This is my soulmate. And I always say to those people, you got about 3 more weeks, okay, in this relationship. And this relationship's going to be over because this is not your soulmate, okay? I mean, who needs more of what you already are, right? That you're not looking for a mirror of yourself, if you will. Now, we have a tendency to think that. What do we share in common? All right. And then if we're in common, then I'm going to have a peaceful relationship because we're going to always think the same and act the same and so on. That isn't the way it generally works. See, the reason I say your soulmate is the person you can't stand, and I say that a bit facetiously, but what I'm saying here is that peace, being at peace, is the essence of feeling worthy. It's the essence of manifesting. It's the essence of enlightenment, being at peace. Any moment that you're at peace, you're in an enlightened state. And when people ask, is there a difference between people who are living at a higher level, self-actualizing people who are at peace, and the rest of us who are not at peace, say, no, we all have peaceful thoughts, and so do enlightened people. They have peaceful thoughts. The only difference is that they have nothing else. That's all they have. They don't have all of this other stuff that goes with it. All of the anger, all of the judgment, all of the fears, all of the anxiety, the stuff that we have come to believe is just a part of our lives. The self-reproachment, the self-repudiation. We have a tendency to think that this is normal. It's only normal. So along come people in your life who know how to push certain buttons. Okay? These people can come in many forms. They can come as in-laws. They can often come, almost always they come as a spouse. And they can come as your children. And when these people show up in your life, they can take you away from your peace. Almost all of us have somebody in our life that we can never get rid of. You know, it's like Kevin Costner talked about in that Waterworld movie of his. You know, they're like a turd that won't flush, you know? You keep flushing, you look at that, still there. If that's a good image or not, but I always liked that image. You know? You keep trying and trying, they're back again, right? So we have these people in our lives. And these people show up and they say something in a certain way, and it doesn't make any difference. If somebody else said it, we would just ignore it. All right? But they come along and they say this thing, and boom, off you go. And you're frantic and you're mad and you're angry, you're upset, you're worked up, you're feeling unworthy. So these people, to me, are your soulmates, you see. Because what they're teaching you at any given moment in your life is you haven't mastered yourself at this moment. You're not in charge of yourself. Those people who can push your buttons and send you into a frenzy or into an angry space or into a space of self-repudiation are people who are divine masters disguised as manipulative, crass, unconcerned people. And rather than being mad at them and being upset with them and saying that they shouldn't be this way, your task ought to be to turn to them and bow and say, I honor you as my teacher. Now that's a hard thing for us to get to, but don't you all have people in your life who are just like that? And you know you're stuck with them. These are people who are not on your path. You know they're not on your path. They're not even on an entrance ramp to your path. They're in a different place. They're from a different planet. But nevertheless, they're there with you. And you're sharing the journey with them. And it's very interesting. I mean, I have 8 children. And my children are the ones that are very good at knowing how to push these buttons. I have one daughter particularly, her name is Serena, that can really do this very well. She's real good at it. She's always giving me advice almost every day on how to be a better parent. She even said to me one time, she said, I can't believe you actually wrote a book on how to be a better parent. I just can't believe that. This is like, she was about 9 years old telling me this. You really wrote that? And whenever she gives me this advice, it's like, or she starts going into one of her routines, I find myself, you know, really being challenged, you know. I don't usually turn around and say, I honor you for, I'm usually saying, well, yeah. But nevertheless, there's a part of me that recognizes this, and I also recognize it in my relationship with my wife. And we've been together for a long time, and there are areas where she will say something and I will find myself, and then I'll stop. You see, because essentially, the ego part of us wants us to be right, whereas the higher part of us always wants what? Peace. That's all it ever wants. So it's like you have to really learn, if you're going to feel worthy of having something show up in your life, how to be peaceful. And the way to be peaceful in your life is to, in all of your relationships, when you have a choice to be right or to be kind, to just pick kind, to just choose to be kind at any given moment in your life. You are honoring that higher part of you, you feel peaceful, and you've let go of the ego need, which says, wait a minute, you're important. And you have to prove that this other person shouldn't have done that and all of that kind of stuff. But Serena, yeah, I remember her telling me, she's great. She would tell me, giving me advice on how to be a parent. And one day I just had it with her. And I said, you know, Serena, I said, it's time for you to stop telling me what kind of a parent to be and stop blaming me for the kind of parent I am and take responsibility yourself for the kind of parent that I am. And she stopped, and she assumed this pose that she always assumes with her hand on her hip, you know, and her knee going up and down real fast. And she said, you want to run that one by me one more time? You want me? Is that what I heard? You want me to be responsible for the kind of parent you are? I said, exactly. She said, well, what are you talking about? I said, well, before you came here, you had a choice. You have certain heroic missions that you have to fulfill while you're here on this planet. I'm giving her this little lecture. You know, she said, well, what do you mean before I came here? She says, I don't remember that. I said, well, your memory isn't anything that you should rely upon to determine whether this works or doesn't work. You don't remember being 4 months old and being in your crib and throwing up all over, but you did. You don't remember your dreams last night. You don't remember what you had for dinner last Thursday. Your memory isn't a good indicator of what it was. Just trust me, this is true. Before you come here, you choose your parents. You get to pick who your parents are. And you have certain lessons that you have to learn, and you picked me to be your father, and you picked mom to be your mother, and you should stop complaining about the choice that you made. She said, I don't remember any of this. I said, well, forget about whether you remember it or not. She said, you're telling me that I chose you to be my father before I came here, and I had lessons to learn through you. I said, exactly. And you should stop blaming me. You should just take responsibility for the choice you made. She said, I must have been in a big hurry. So, these are your tests, all right? I'll tell you the greatest one, though. I mean, my wife had gone away. She's working on a book herself on a spiritual approach to childbirth and infancy care. And she went away for a month, and I took over Mr. Mom for 30 days while she rented a house on Maui. We live in Florida. She was making sure she wasn't coming home on weekends, like I do. And I was making breakfast one morning, and they were all sitting over at the table, and I was making waffles. And so I'm at the toaster in the back, and the children are behind me, and all of a sudden I hear my 13-year-old daughter, who is Summer, saying to my 11-year-old, Serena, she asked this question out of the blue. She said, Serena, she said, if you didn't have any feet, would you wear shoes? And I turned around and, what in the world? What kind of a question is that? And Serena looked at her and said, what do you mean if I didn't have any feet, would I wear shoes? She said, of course not. And Summer said to her, well, why are you wearing that bra? So, I'm telling you, they can be tough. So what I would like you to think about is that all of the people in your life that you find yourself in conflict with or having a difficult time with, whether they're strangers or spouses or children or grandparents or in-laws or even people who are no longer here on this earth plane, if you can say to yourself, when I have this choice at any given moment to be right or to be kind, and I'm going to let my ego get out of this thing, and I'm going to choose to be at peace, as it says in the Course in Miracles, I can choose peace rather than this at any given moment. And then when you find yourself in these relationships with contentious people, and you find yourself being able to be at peace, when they push those buttons, you'll know that the reason that they showed up in your life in the first place is to teach you to honor your own worthiness. That's why you're with them. That's what they're there for. These are teachers, just like you are teachers to others.
All relationships have their own path that they have to traverse, and the way I think of a relationship is I think that the relationship is bigger than the people that are in it. It's the relationship itself that is beyond just the individuals. And if you're in a parent-child relationship, that relationship exists in the world. Now, it exists in each person. It's located in each person. But it's also outside of those people as well. It's in that invisible realm. And there is a great deal of time in a parent-child relationship in which there are inequities. Those inequities don't seem right to the person who is doing all of the giving. But if you're on purpose, you know that giving is all that it's about anyway. And one of the songs that comes to mind is about there's a time for giving, there's a time for loving, there's a time for receiving. And there is sort of a timing that goes into a relationship. And that timing is that when a child is a baby, they are totally, completely dependent upon you. And so it's about 100% giving. And what you get back, of course, are those big eyes and those beautiful looks and those gurgling sounds and that beautiful smile and it's all invisible. I mean, you know that they're communicating love to you, but they certainly aren't going to pay you an allowance. They're not going to pay rent. And they're not going to provide you with what you're providing them with. They're not going to buy you clothes because you buy them. But there's a sequence to it all. It's all in divine perfection. There's like a birth, and then there's a death, and then there's a rebirth, and that's how the whole universe works in perfect sequence. And the time will come you'll go through the teenage years, the years when you just, I call the age of demonic possession, you know, kiddingly, when you will receive back a lot of, you know, who are you? You don't care about me. You don't know anything. And then there's the time when those people will get old themselves, and the child who was the child now becomes the parent, and then the parent then later becomes the child and needs to be taken care of again. And it's all in perfect sequence. And you, the way that you deal with all of that is that you do trust and you surrender and you know that it's in divine order. And you don't tell yourself that it shouldn't be this way and why do I have to do all the work and how come. It's just exactly the way it's supposed to be, and you're fitting in just the way you want to. And your feelings towards those people, for example, towards your children, are such that the thoughts and the feelings that you have are what the quality of that relationship is. There are some differences that exist in all relationships that are never going to go away. The differences are going to be there. The awakened point of view from the person who is really awakening and moving beyond success. Remember, success almost always means accumulation or winning, or moving beyond achievement, which almost always means you have to get more than the other guy, or performance, which means competition and I have to outperform the other person. All of those are very much a part of our culture, and there's nothing wrong with them. But to be principal motivators in your life, they just keep you at a much lower level. And to get to the awakened level where you're beyond those things, you have to see that success, achievement, and performance all have built into them somebody else has to lose in order for you to win. Almost always, somebody else has to lose. And so now what you want to do is approach the conflict that you're experiencing from a nobody has to lose position, from a win-win position. And that's become a very popular slogan and philosophy in business in recent years. Well, in a relationship, it means getting off of my need to be right and instead looking at the differences that are in somebody and celebrating those differences and agreeing to disagree for, if necessary, for the rest of your life about them. My wife and I have done this in many, many areas. She has a much more of an organized approach to life, and she has all of her reasons for it. We have 7 children, we have clothes that have to be done, we have this, that, we have a thousand things that have to be done every single day, and if I didn't know where things were and couldn't go to them instantly, I couldn't function. When I meditate on that, that makes absolutely perfect sense to me. All right? On the other hand, I am much more into spontaneity and feel that I have to be in the work that I do. And even if I don't have to be, I just don't like organizing. I don't like making a bed. I've never thought there was anything healthier about getting into a made bed than an unmade bed, you know, psychologically or in any other way. And I have more of a tendency to allow things to be disorganized. Not in total disarray, but just disorganized. And I think very, very strongly that you fall in love with when you are in a love relationship, you fall in love with the things in another person that you don't have in yourself. Because to fall in love with somebody who has everything that is exactly the same as you is to have a redundant relationship. I mean, you've already got that. What do you need more of it for? I think the whole business about opposites attracting, almost every marriage is like that. And the marriages usually that don't work are the ones where people have so much in common. And yet you'll hear people at the beginning say, oh, we have so much in common. Well, he says this, and I say the same thing, and he likes to do this, and I like to do that, and he's an athlete, and I like athletes, and they think that that's such a wonderful thing, you know, that we have all these things in common. And I always think, uh-oh, this one's doomed. We got some real problems here. But when someone says, she's just the exact opposite of me, you know, I just get almost always, and that's where the most intensity is. Now, the intensity is on both sides. The intensity is in the love, and so you love that person intensely, and you look at them, and you realize that they are many things that I am not and can't be, and I like that. I like having that around me. I need that organization around me. I need that passion around me. I need that person who talks a lot around me because I'm very quiet. That is what endears you to someone. And then what happens is you get into a relationship and you forget that that's what you fell in love with. You fell in love with those qualities that are so different than what you have that gives you spice and fills you, makes you more complete.
as a human being, because you've got that in you. Then you turn those areas, those differences, which are the very thing that attracted you to the person in the first place, into areas of conflict or areas of confrontation. And we begin to try to alter the person that we love. And when you try to alter something, you don't prove that you love it. You prove that you want it to be different. And so in relationships, you have to remember, you have to go back to what you fell in love with. It's always an opposite. You just don't need a mirror of yourself. You've already got that all the time. In marriages and in love relationships and live-in relationships and even with your children and all of that, the thing about your children that usually endears you the most to them is not that they're like you, is the things that they do that are not like you. Those are the things that you respect the most. That little kid who will stand up to the teacher and take the slings and arrows that go with standing up to the teacher. On one hand, you don't want your child to be disobedient, but there's always a little corner of you back there that says, you know, I never had the courage to do that myself, and I don't want him to ever not do that. You begin to admire those things, that, and you learn from them, and they become your teachers. So you turn those areas into something that is very positive and something very beautiful. That's like making conflict, which is not abrasiveness and ugliness, but just differences, something to honor, to dance with, to celebrate, to be with. And then you become solution-oriented. You become focused instantly on the solution to that. And oftentimes, most often, the solution to the differences in relationships is to honor and celebrate the very things that are different in the other person and respect that.
Relationships that work because there is no work. I've never liked the idea of having to work on my relationship. You know, I go to work all day, and I'm going to get in my car, and I got to go home, and what are you going to do? I got to go work on my relationship. I'm working all day, and I'm working all night, and it's the whole thing is a struggle. I do think there are certain kinds of things. Let's take a relationship first. You do have to be considerate of, and so on, but by and large, when you're at harmony with somebody, and when you're in that place that I call no limits, where you know that the person that you're in a relationship with is not that form or that body. That isn't, because right now I'm in a relationship with my wife and she's 2,000 miles away. That doesn't mean that because I'm not connected to her form right now, that relationship isn't there, doesn't exist. It's in thought. And when I get closer and closer and closer, when I get to the house and walk into the house and I see her, I'm still only processing her through my mind. It's still only thought. If what I have is loving thought, and that's up to me, that's totally up to me. What I don't have is judgmental thought, and that's up to me as well. And I don't have negative thought, that's up to me. I choose all of that. That's where I am as a human being. Then my relationship will always be perfect. You see, most people in relationships, they say this. Here's how it works. They say, I'm in a relationship. And someone says, oh, yeah, really? You're in a relationship? Yeah. We got problems. And someone say, oh, you've got problems in your relationship, yeah. Then the next conclusion is, there must be something wrong. There's got to be something wrong. You say, well, let's see, now you're in a relationship and you've got problems, and so there's something wrong. So let's see, who am I going to call in to help me with this relationship? And, of course, you can't afford to have somebody coming in all the time, so you have to call on yourself. That's the only person or the other person who's in the relationship. But you're already calling in somebody who's wrong because you've just admitted that if you've got problems, there's something wrong. So what you're doing is you're calling in a disabled person to deal with the problems in your relationship because that person is now wrong. If you were going to call in a therapist to help you with the relationship and the therapist was really whiny and you know, do this and you do that, that's the problem. Let's say that's a problem. The way we talk to each other in our relationship is, I do this and you do that and I can't do that. And you say, well, that's a problem. Now, there's something wrong. Right, who are we going to call in to fix it? Well, we're going to call in a therapist. And they walk in, and the therapist walks in, and they say, well, what do you want? How come you're calling me all day? I don't know. I've got to do this. You say, wait a minute. How's that person going to help me? That person's wrong. All right? Well, that's what you do in a relationship. When you say you've got problems and there's something wrong, or you say there's something missing, that's even funnier to me. I mean, what could be missing? There's nothing missing in your relationship. Like, you got to start looking for what isn't there. Everything that's there is what you've chosen to have. And everything that isn't there is what you've chosen to have. There's nothing missing. You are you, they are they, and that's it. There's nothing missing in your relationship. So what you have to do is you have to reverse that in a relationship. And you have to say, I'm in a relationship. You say, yeah. Say, we've got problems. Yeah, that's true. We do too. There's nothing wrong with that. In other words, now you don't have a wrong person, a disabled person who's got to come in and consult and help with the relationship.
Every relationship has problems, has disagreements, has certain conditions that have to be resolved. But there's nothing wrong. In other words, nobody has to be wrong. Nobody has to be right. Most people in relationships spend most of their time in making the other person wrong, which means making themselves right. And they spend their whole life and energy on making somebody else wrong and making themselves right. Once you say, all right, well, my wife likes to do things this way and I like to do things that way, and you say to yourself, well, there's nothing wrong with that. She's who she is, I'm who I am, and she can do them that way, and that's perfectly fine, I understand that, and I'll do them my way. But I'm not going to make her wrong, and she's not going to make me wrong because I like to do it a certain way. She's much more fanatical about cleaning than I am. So she doesn't make that my problem. I don't make my not having to have everything orderly her problem. When she sees things that are left around that she doesn't like, she's perfectly willing to pick them up because she knows that that's what she wants. We don't have to have a fight about it. And that's really what enlightenment is. It's really just not having to call in a consultant who was wrong and trying to make somebody right and somebody wrong all the time. Every relationship has differences. And some people are going to think of it as right, and some people are going to think of it as wrong. Then you're going to always have problems. But if you understand that we're going to have conditions, we're going to have things that we don't like, we don't have to make anybody wrong. It's a wonderful approach to life. You're not busy making people wrong. If everybody could stop needing to take credit and needing to make somebody else wrong, you could improve about 99% of the relationships. I do this now with my wife. We do it kind of jokingly. The kids will come home and one of them will have done something that's really spectacular. And my wife will take the credit. You know, she'll say, well, I was the one that taught her how to do that. There was a time when I would have said, wait a minute, I'm the one who taught that. I'll tell you, why are you taking the credit for what I taught? Now I will say, well, if I understand that we're all one. I understand the unity of this whole thing. And I do it with sort of a smug kind of laugh on my face. If you did it, then I did it. And I'm just as pleased. So congratulations. We'd kind of joke and say, oh, yeah, you did it, I did it, and all that. But we just kind of laugh. We are now able to laugh at and treat, just sort of in an offhand way, things that previously would have caused dissension and difficulty. Because nobody has to make anybody wrong. And in fact, that is the truth. We are all one, all of us, not just in the family. We're all part of it. And if one person is succeeding, then all of us are. And if one is dying or hungry or hurting, then all of us are doing that as well.
Magical relationships, making your relationships magic instead of filled with conflict, instead of filled with pain, instead of the struggle that we go through. Most of us, when we look at the things that have really pained us in our life, have been relationship difficulties, divorces, separations, being away from the children, having to leave friends, death of people that we were very close to, relationships ending, relationships changing and shifting. So what you want to do is take this miracle mindset that I've been talking about in these tapes and these ingredients of relationships on purpose, which is relationships that are about giving, not expecting and not getting, and begin to apply some specifics to them. Here are some of those. As always, you begin the process by removing the doubt and the disbelief in your ability to pull it off. You have to know that you can make your relationships work, and that fighting and struggling and impossible relationships do not have to be in the way of things for you. It has nothing to do with others. It's all located within you. You remove the doubt. You affirm aloud that you are entitled to be happy with everyone in your life. Keep that in mind. I am entitled to happiness in every relationship in my life. When doubt creeps in, as it will because you've been taught the big lie, remind yourself that you've been hypnotized to believe that these things are impossible. Send the doubt away. When you send the doubt away, then you'll be able to create magical relationships. And the doubt that it can't happen is the thing that keeps it from happening. Remember, there's doubt, and then there's knowing. There's fear, and then there is love. So doubt and fear are one way, knowing and love are the other. So now you've removed the doubt and you shift to this magic zone that I've been talking about over and over again on these tapes. Within your mind and only in your mind, in that corner of freedom where you can think what you want to, you can get images of happiness and fulfillment for all others. You can see yourself sending out love in the face of the opposite that's being directed at you. You can think of the person who's the most difficult for you to imagine being with in a magical relationship. Maybe it's your mother-in-law. Maybe it's your neighbor. Maybe it's some difficult person that you just can't. Maybe it's your own, one of your own parents or one of your own children that you've had a tough time with. Maybe it's an aging, inconsiderate grandparent or a coworker or a tyrannical spouse or whatever it is, or an ex-spouse. Imagine now in your mind that you can overcome your inclination to respond with anger and hostility. Try to picture them as who they are on purpose, having shown up in your life at exactly the right time with the exact right personality to teach you how to overcome people like this. You can see them that way. You're not doing this for what you're going to receive. In a magical relationship, each person gives what they want to get, but you suspend the want and you do it from purpose. So this mental practice will become your reality in the physical world. You take that aging, difficult parent or grandparent or in-law, you take that person in your mind and you say, I am going to spend an hour with that person and it's going to be loving. And nothing is going to stop it from being that way because I don't care what I get. It's not about getting, it's about purpose, which is about giving. So I'm just going to give for an hour. And no matter what they give back, it isn't going to be anything that I'm going to embrace. And so they come in and they start telling you how terrible you are and that this doesn't work and wipe your feet and blow your nose and you didn't shave and this didn't work out. And you just reach your arm out and you say, you know, you are terrific. Pointing out that I didn't shave, oh, I needed that today. That's really great. And you're just sending them love. And you bring them a gift and you just tell them how great they are and you remind yourself how sensational they are. And inside, you're reminding yourself, I don't need to make them wrong. They're just who they are. They're just behaving exactly the way I have taught them to behave toward me for an entire lifetime. They need someone to argue with, and I have provided them with that character. I'm not going to provide them with that character today. And before you know it, you have taken an impossible relationship and made it into something grand.
I've traveled the whole country in the last year or so talking about raising children. What do you really want for your children? And taking calls on talk shows over and over again across the country. Almost all of the calls are about the things their kids are doing wrong. I don't think I got a call in 400 interviews about how terrific their kids were and how great they are and how nice they are and what a joy this whole parenting business is and what a treat it is and what a blessing it is and how lucky we are to be able to do this thing. It was always, my kid does this and how can I get him to do that and they won't do this and how do I motivate them and how do I get them to clean up the room and how come they sass me back. And one of the philosophies that I have that is really crucial is this whole concept of catching your children doing things right instead of catching them doing things wrong. And it's really an approach to parenting that I have seen that really works in helping children to motivate themselves, because I don't really believe that any of us can motivate our children. I think that the best that we can do is provide a terrific environment and an opportunity for them to help them to motivate themselves, because they're on their own path, just like you're on yours. And what we can do is teach love, live love, help them to be love, and help them to have that inside of them, and then sort of guide, then step aside, and allow them to go in the direction that they're going to go. But while you're in this business of guiding and helping and parenting, if you will, there's a whole business of making it a pleasant journey. I mean, anything in life can either be a pleasant journey or it can be a horrendous journey, and it's entirely up to you. It's always an attitude. Attitude or what you believe or your internal approach to life always determines how your life is going to go. I don't know if you've ever noticed that loving people live in a loving world and hateful people live in a hateful world, and it's the same world. You see, it's like what you have in your heart and what you're looking for and what your expectations are determine everything for you in your life. And it's a crucial thing in raising our children to understand that what they learn to expect and what they learn to think and how they learn to value and celebrate the moments of their life is going to be the determining factor in what kind of human beings they are. And if they're raised to see negative, and if they're raised to believe that things aren't going to work out, and if they're raised to be hateful and to look for the negative in everything in life, then that's what they're going to find. The job of parenting is, I can sum it up in two things. First of all, I think that our purpose as a parent is to help our children to become their own parents. That's number one, and that's really crucial. Your job is not to or my job, I don't see it as a parent, is not to get your children to obey you, to do what they are told to do, to follow the rules that you set down for them, and to behave when you're around. It isn't that at all. It's to help them to develop an inner sense of who they are as human beings and where they can go and what they can do based upon inner signals, not outer rules and regulations and demands of parents, but to teach them to be their own parent. Very much like I think our job as being healthy people is to teach ourselves to be our own doctors, rather than always relying on somebody to heal us, to learn how to be healthy ourselves and to how to heal ourselves so that we don't depend on somebody else to do it for us. And how a teacher's job is to teach children to be their own teachers rather than to rely on somebody else to educate them. And I think in parenting, that's the most important thing. And also to teach children somehow to have an appreciation for life, to value it, to celebrate it, to love it, to look for the gloriousness in life rather than to always be seeking out the negative or being beaten down by it and so on. And in writing What Do You Really Want for Your Children, it was crucial for me to help my children to grow up that way and to help others in the same light. Really, when you ask the question, what do you really want for your children? And I asked this of thousands and thousands of people across the country. The answers were not what you might expect. They weren't, I want my son to become a doctor. I want my son or my daughter to become a lawyer. I want them to make a lot of money. I want them, you know, in this Western sort of world where we live in a land of accumulations and acquisitions and achievement and dominance, rather than the opposite kinds of things, which are serenity and quality of life and knowledge rather than achievements. You would think that people would be thinking, what I want for my kids is to get as much as they can get, because there's so much of that in our culture. And parents, really, most of us don't want that for our children. We want something quite different for them. When you ask, the answers that you get are really interesting. They all center around well-being. They all center around this internalness of a child. And what they have to learn and what we have to help them to learn is that inner direction, or running our lives on our own inner signals, our own inner principles, is such a simple thing, and yet we seem to have so much difficulty with it. I want my children to celebrate the present moments of their life and not always be heading someplace else. I want them to have peak experiences in life. I want them to enjoy every moment, like Walt Whitman said. He said, every cubic inch of space is a miracle. So many of us are out there looking for miracles, trying to find one, trying to get there. And we never stop and say, this is it. This is where I am right now. Enjoy it, live it, celebrate it, value it. Each child that you bring into the world, that you take responsibility for as a parent, has only got now. The past is a canceled check, it's over. The future is promised to none of us. All they have are these moments. Children know how to live those moments until we take it out of them. They see a caterpillar. And they'll just look at that for hours. They can get lost in it. I remember doing dishes with my daughter one time, and you know how when they get grease in the sink, and then you put some soap in there, and you get like a rainbow in there? And she was about 6 or 7. She said, what's that? Look at those colors. What is that? And I was busy. I had work to do. I said, oh, no, that's nothing. That's just water. Come on, let's go. And then I stopped myself and remembered. You know, to her, this is a miracle. This is something to see. And she could spend a half an hour on that. And I just remember stopping myself right there and trying to explain it. And looking at it and trying to understand what happens when water and soap and oil all combine, and that's how rainbows are made, and all this kind of thing, and we talked about that. And she could have spent a day on that because she was into her moments. She's not talking about what she should have done or what she could have done or if only and all of that. They're there. I used to be told that, Wayne, you don't even have sense enough to come out of the rain. It was because I love the rain. And I enjoyed the rain. And the snowstorm was something to go out and enjoy and to have fun with. It wasn't something to say, oh, I got to drive in this and I got to get the, oh, we got slush and then it's going to turn to ice and then it's going to be cold. Yeah, it's easy for you to say, you're a kid, but you don't have to go out and do what I have to do. All of those negative things that you say
don't make the snow go away. The snow is still there, and if you've chosen to be in a place where you have to drive to work and put snow tires on your car, that still doesn't change the snow. You can still appreciate it. You can still value it like your children do. We just have to allow them to do that instead of always having them setting goals, always having them trying to get someplace else. Look, life is what happens to you while you're making other plans, okay? All of this stuff that you're trying to get over here, this stuff here that goes by is called life. So if you have goals, fine, great, nothing wrong with goals, but enjoy every moment along the way. If you're going someplace a week from Friday, and that's, but this is still Monday. Enjoy Monday.
The first 10 years of my life, I spent in a series of foster homes and orphanages. My mother had three boys by the time she was very young, in her early 20s. And my father abandoned his family. He just left. He took off one day. And he had been a person who never took the responsibility of being a father very seriously. He didn't give any money. He was an alcoholic. He abused my mother physically. And the last time that he did it, a policeman came to the house. And I was just a tiny baby, a few months old. My brother was 16 months older than me, and another brother who was 3.5 years older than me. And the policeman told my mother, right there on the east side of Detroit, you're going to have to get away from this man, or your life is going to be a hell for the rest of your life. And so she just made that decision, and he left. He just took off. And I never saw him again in my life, ever. I never saw him, period, that I have any memory of. Well, I was born in 1940. There was a depression in the world. There was a war getting going. There was no welfare. There were no food stamps, things like that. So that what people did in those times was they reached out either to the church or to people who would open up their homes and help out. People helping people was how people got through these kinds of things, rather than relying on the government or something. It just wasn't there. So my brother Dave and I, my next oldest brother, went into a series of homes and ended up in an orphanage kind of place out in Mount Clemens, Michigan. And my oldest brother went with my grandmother and was raised by her until I was about 9 or 10. And then my mother remarried and got us back together. And she did it again. She married a similar kind of person, an alcoholic, abuser, and so on. But I think that each person on the path has to learn for themselves. And this must have been what she had to learn. She's one of the most beautiful, positive human beings you'd ever want to meet in your life. I think of her as a saint. She was always up, and all my years with her were, our home was the home in the neighborhood that all the kids wanted to come to, because my mother never complained. She would get up in the morning and make sandwiches and never missed work. In 20 years, never missed work. I mean, would take three buses through the worst of winters in Detroit, take three buses back home, and then make dinner, and never complained. Very positive, upright, terrific lady, and I have a very good relationship with her now. She lives down in Florida, not too far from us, and it's a joy to have her in our lives. But in those early days, I was a kid that you probably will recognize, because almost all of you have one in your family. I came home from school in the third grade, after the first day of school, and my teacher's name was Mrs. Poole. And Mrs. Poole was talking to the principal. They were talking back and forth, and I heard Mrs. Poole say to the principal that Wayne Dyer was in her class. And the principal was sort of commiserating with her about that. And then I heard Mrs. Poole say that Wayne Dyer was a scurvy elephant in her classroom. Well, I didn't know what that meant. I'd never heard that term before. So I went right home to Mrs. Scarf, whose home we lived in, where a lot of children lived. She took in an awful lot of children in her lifetime. Some of them were handicapped in one way or another, and a lot of them were just poor, like we were. And she was terrific. And I asked her, what was a scurvy elephant? She said, well, I don't know. She said, but I'll check it out. So she got on the telephone and called the principal, and the principal said, oh, no, that's Wayne. He gets everything wrong. She didn't say that he was a scurvy elephant in her classroom. She said he was a disturbing element in her classroom, okay? Now, I'm going to be talking about scurvy elephants here. And being a scurvy elephant has certain kind of meaning to me because I lived that way all my life. I was one of those kids who was in trouble a lot, who was sort of, as Thoreau said, marching to his own music, to his own drummer, and wouldn't or couldn't be told what to do. I have to still admit to having a lot of difficulty with that. Being told what to do is something that I don't take kindly to. In doing my research for What Do You Really Want for Your Children, one of the things that we found out, which was really interesting, is that children who are raised to be blindly obedient and to do exactly as they're told and to never ask questions and to say, yes, sir, no, sir, you do things as you're told, those are the children with the highest levels of prejudice in their lives. That almost always, when you see people who have real high levels of prejudice, they were raised to be blindly obedient. And it makes sense when you think about it, because if you don't let your children ask questions and inquire and think and want to figure things out why for themselves, they'll just say what they're told. And if you're told to hate this person over here because they have religious beliefs that are different than yours, then you just do that. A scurvy elephant would say, well, wait a minute. Why should I hate this person because they... I'd like to check that out. What does it mean to be have a different religious... Or why should I hate this person over here because their skin color is different than mine? How come? I don't understand that. Let me check. And they will go check those people out. And you find when you go check people out, that is, when you go up to them and you talk to them, that you no longer need to prejudge them, which is what prejudice is. It's just prejudging. You suddenly find out that they're people just like you are. So you eliminate prejudice. The way to eliminate prejudice is to have contact, to be with someone, rather than to be just sit back and say, no, I don't want anything to do with anybody who thinks like you do, who looks like you, who worships like you, who acts like you do, or who reads those kind of books, or who belongs to that political party, or whatever. And so if you want your children to be inquiring and open, then you have to be careful about raising them to be blindly obedient. In doing the research for this book, I also discovered a great quotation, which was that the one you can do the least with will probably make you the most proud. And one of the things that I learned as a family therapist is that parents would bring their scurvy elephants into me, okay? And they would all sit around, they'd say, no, I just can't get this kid to do what he's told to do. And if you can just, all I want you to do is get him to do what he's told, all right? That's what they're asking me to get this kid to do what he's told. I never did it once in my life, all right? And I would say, well, what is, you know, let's discuss this and we do kind of family therapy kind of things. And I would see that the parents, as frustrated as they were with these children or this child that they had who was sort of going their own way in life, despite the best parental interference that could come along, I could see the parents saying, I want you to get him to change. I'll do anything. I'll pay you extra if you can get this kid to change. But somewhere secretly down inside each one of those parents was this wish that the child would always resist it. They were always wishing and hoping that it wouldn't be taken out of them. To take that scurviness out of that scurvy elephant, if you will, is something that most of us don't want, because you know what that kid symbolizes? They symbolize what we would like to have been, how we would like to have stood up to authority. And the one thing I can always tell you about my mother, as many times as she had to go and get me back in school, or talk to the principal about this or that thing that I had run into, this difficulty I had run into along the way with authority figures, the thing that I always remember when we would get back on the bus afterwards and she'd say, now, Wayne, you know, you got to go to school, and in the school there are certain rules, and she would always say, but if you really believe in it, if you really believe, don't stop fighting it. Don't stop.
Every time you are upset or your children are upset because of what somebody else says about them, including their peers, what you are really saying in that moment, and this is really important, what you're saying is, what you think of me is more important than what I think of myself. And you must never give anybody that kind of power and control over you, because they will always have it. And I used to tell my students in counseling over and over again, if you really want approval and you're telling me that you need it, all right, we'll put that down over here, even though that's like sort of not a very healthy way to look at it. But let's just say your goal is approval, as much of it you can get. Now, Tell me who gets the most approval in life. Tell me the person that you know in your life who gets approved of more than anybody. And they will describe somebody like that. And then I'll say, do you realize that that person you've described doesn't even care about whether they get approval? I think the most important thing that we can do as parents is to provide two things for our children. One is a positive approach to life, so that they're not out there complaining and whining and being beaten down by it all the time. And so many people grow up to be these neurotic people who are complaining and whining and finding fault with everything in life and wishing that life were different or feeling that life handed them a dirty deal. With my children, I want them to just believe that life is good, that it's terrific. Don't look for miracles. Live one, all right, every day. That's the one thing. And the other is teaching our children not to be blamers, you know, to take responsibility for what you are in your life, whether it's when you're 1 year old or when you're 14 or any time in between. If you learn early in your life not to blame everybody else for what is going on in your life, not to find fault with someone else. You ever see in a classroom where the kids will all come out after a test and they get their test results back, and you'll hear one say, I got an A. The other say, well, I got a B plus. I got 93. And then another one will say, she flunked me. You know, it's like somebody else did those bad things to me. And in every area of my children's lives, I try to teach them, you are what you choose to be. From the simplest things, like whether you're getting a cold or whether the flu is getting you or whatever, to the most dramatic things in your life, like how well you're doing in school or what your relationships are like as you go through your life or to what level you have or don't have financial security in your life. If they can just learn that it isn't just something that is visited on them, but in fact it is something that they have chosen, even if you're wrong, at least you have an opportunity to try to go to work on it. When you grow up to believe that, you tell your children over and over, and you're just like your father. You know, you inherited that from your father. Or you don't have any musical ability because your father couldn't sing. Or you got that from your grandmother. It's like when you tell your children that it's their chromosomes or their genetics that are causing what's going on for them in their lives, how do you alter your chromosomes? How do you alter your genetics? Those things are fixed. But when you believe that it's a choice and it comes from within you what you are, the child can become anything they want in their lives. As a parent, I know that the most important thing I can provide for my children is an example. If I'm a person who's whining and finding fault with myself in life and not feeling very fulfilled and feeling like I'm being beaten down by life, and my children see that day in and day out, a father or a mother who's out there whining and saying that, oh, this isn't right, or the IRS is after me this time, or the president's policies are making me upset, or my boss doesn't understand me, or I didn't get any breaks in life. And they hear that kind of stuff over and over again. Or if they hear you being dishonest, you know, and cheating over here, or lying, or whatever it is, or if they see you drunk all the time. I always tell parents, if you went to a dentist, and your dentist was smiling at you through rotting out blackened teeth, okay, and he was telling you about the importance of sound oral hygiene practices, you would say, this guy's a phony. This is somebody that is selling me a tainted product. I don't want to listen to his advice. If you go to your doctor and he's blowing smoke in your face and he's telling you about the evils of addiction, you're also dealing with somebody who isn't authentic. They're just simply not authentic, and their advice isn't very believable. The same thing is true in parenting. If you're not at least operating at a higher level than your child is in these given areas, then you're not only going to not be able to help your child, but you'll probably get in his way. It doesn't mean that you have to be perfect. It doesn't mean that you have to be flawless or anything like that. It simply means that you are operating at a level in your life and you're working on that yourself. I have no trouble admitting to my children when I make a mistake anymore, whereas at one time in my life I did. I have no difficulty crying in front of my child if I'm feeling sad about something or expressing any particular point of view to my children. I want them to see an authentic person who isn't in a role of parent. That isn't my role. I am a human being who has a mission and a destiny in life, and you are a part of that because we are in the same family together. Being authentic, just being authentic, being genuine, being a real human being for your children is really crucial, in my opinion.
Helping somebody else achieve a sense of purpose is a part of the mission of what it means to be a parent, in my estimation. But you can't do it for them. If you've got people in your family, young people, teenagers, who are negative, the best thing I think that you can do for them is to provide them a model, an example, if you will, of somebody who isn't going to allow their behavior, their attitudes, the kinds of things that they're doing in their lives to disrupt and ruin even 1 hour of your life. You can make clear to them that you're there to help them. You can have talks with them. You can explain to them. But in the end, they will know that you mean what you're all about by what you live rather than by what you say or what you tell them to do. So that's all out crucial. In other words, if your child comes home from school and has a D in algebra and a poor mark in citizenship in school, is that a reason for you to ruin a day of your life? First question you have to ask yourself. Whose problem is this? And why are you going to make it yours by immobilizing yourself and making yourself upset? Yes, you can do things like restrict certain kind of privileges. Certainly, I don't believe in total just ignoring of somebody and letting them permissively do whatever they choose. You can help them by getting tutors for them and provide conversations with them and so on and be a helping, caring person. But what you should never do is to say to you, get yourself all worked up, get yourself miserable, and find yourself being fretting and upset in your life. You have to teach them that their behavior is just that. It's their behavior. Not only do they own it, but they have to take the responsibility and the consequences for it. I always tell parents who find themselves with obstreperous kids or children who are abusive or disrespectful and so on, and I talk to mothers, and I'll say, what is your behavior like toward that child? I'll say, well, let's see, I make his lunches for him. Let's say you've got a child who calls you names. And then your response is, oh, well, you know, he's just finding himself or whatever. And I'll just make his lunch for him, and then I'll chauffeur him to his tennis lessons or pick him up from school. In other words, I could say to her or him, I can't force you to be respectful to me. I can't force that. I can't put words in your mouth. But what I can certainly not do is reward you for it. I am going to show you that when you want to behave that way, then you're going to have to do that in isolation away from me. And I am not going to be somebody who's going to continuously wait on you and do all of the things. Like, and also, by the way, I believe that children learn by doing. They don't learn by somebody else doing things for them. Any of you who have children over the ages of 8 and are still doing their laundry, you ought to be examining what it is that you're doing that for. I mean, an 8-year-old is perfectly capable of working a washing machine and a dryer. Very simple little thing. You do theirs for 8 years, they do yours for 8 years. That seems to make a lot of sense. And you alternate after the second 8 years. Like, you ask yourself, what do you owe your children? You don't owe them a slave. You don't owe them being a victim. You don't owe them having to give up and sacrifice your life. What I think you owe them, because you make a choice to bring them into the world, is being a model of a loving, caring human being who is fully functioning in her and his own life, who has a sense of meaning and mission yourself. And when your children see that in you, they will naturally come along. Where you encourage independence. You don't encourage them to be dependent on you, but you permit them to make the kind of mistakes and to fail and to all of the things that go with what it means to grow up to be a healthy person. But mostly, you don't model that you're going to reinforce. You go into a neurotic behavior. You go into a grocery store, and you're with your child, and your child says, I want a piece of bubble gum. And you say, you can't have a piece of bubble gum. And you say, the child comes back, I want a piece of bubble gum. I told you, you're not having a piece of I want a piece of bubble gum, I want a piece of bubble gum, you want a piece of bubble gum. They scream and all right. You want a piece of bubble gum? Here, have a piece of bubble gum. Here's a penny, go to the machine. Message, if you want a piece of bubble gum, you have to be crazy. That's what you've taught your child. When my daughter and every daughter and every son in the world tries that when they're little, would say to me, I want a piece of bubble gum, and I would say no, and I'd say, hold it, that's terrific. Let's get everybody over here. We're going to put on a show. I brought a gorilla with me, you know, from the... and show them that I am not going to be intimidated, bulldozed, manipulated, victimized by your behavior. And your behavior is not going to be encouraged. If you make lunches, if you take a, pick a child up and are the chauffeur for that child and do all of the things again and give them money and blah, 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 and then turn around and have them abusive towards you and then continue this lifestyle over here, all you're doing is saying, I would like you to continue being nasty toward me, and here, let me reinforce it. I don't think you should be doing that.
One of the things that we do in families is that we reward children for being sick, and we punish them for being well, which is the exact opposite of how you would want to reinforce given behaviors. If a child gets sick, then we pay more attention to them, we cuddle them, we let them stay home from school, we put wraps around them, we bring a television into them, we bring them some soda pop, which they may not otherwise get. We go in and talk to them all the time, we feel their forehead, we massage them. You know, it's like when you're sick, you get lots and lots of attention. In Gifts from Icus, I had a notion that on the planet where Icus lives, they had this thing straightened out, that you're, what you do is you send your doctor a check every month as long as you're well. But when you get sick, you stop payment because his job is wellness, not sickness, all right? I think that same logic can apply in the raising of our children or in how we treat ourselves. And that is when any of my children respond to me that they don't feel well or they're getting a cold or whatever, my response initially is always, oh, you're not going to get that cold. You're too strong for that. You are so fantastic. You are such a healthy person. I know you'll beat it. Everybody else might get it, not you. All right? And when I hear a lot of kind of whiny, complainy, I don't feel well with this, or my nose is running, or my eyes hurt, or my ear, I kind of let that go. But I respond to how well they look. You know, you look fantastic today. Oh, you're so healthy. Look at what you can do. In other words, it's reinforcing wellness instead of reinforcing sickness and giving children rewards for being sick. Where I grew up, the lady used to tell us that if the window was open, that you'll catch a cold. You know, and it's like all the kids in this home that I lived in for a few years, the children would go around with colds all the time. And I used to say, but Mrs. Scarf, I was out all day, and we were playing hockey, and the wind would be 30 miles an hour, and why would I get a cold just because I have the window? Because I like to sleep in a room that is nice and cool with a breeze blowing. Well, you'll just get a cold. The cold germs are in the air. She used to even tell us the cold germs are in the linoleum. If you walk across the linoleum with your bare feet, they'll somehow come up through your feet and land in your nose. Somehow they live in that. It's just a silly little thing that people buy into, and I never have. I have never bought into it in my own life. If I do get a little sniffle or something, I treat it as a mistake. I tell no one about it. I'm not interested in having it be a part of what I... And for so many years, I have said in public places that I don't get colds, that I have set myself to the point where it's impossible. I would be too embarrassing. I mean, I have to go in a closet someplace and close the door and have a cold. So I just don't think cold thoughts anymore. And I try to reinforce wellness thinking in myself and in my children and in the people that I deal with.
Creativity. And it goes hand in hand with perhaps the most important thing I want for my children. I want them to feel a sense of purpose. I want them to feel valuable. I want them to have a spiritual sense of the magnificence that they are. Not in some external sense, and not even in any religious sense, but instead of looking for God and praying for God to do things for them, to understand that they have that within them. That the kingdom of heaven is within. It's a way of living. It's not a place that you get to. That when you have purpose, and the way that you get purpose, look, you can feed your kids sprouts every day. You can give your kids carrot sticks all the time and do all the things that I've talked about here. But if you've got junk inside of you, they're going to get it. Let them see a model of a human being who is living the very things I've been talking about here. Let them see someone who feels purposeful, who isn't being beaten down by any system, who isn't being controlled or manipulated by anyone else, who does enjoy every moment of their life. Let them see that, who looks and feels good about themselves. Let them see that day in and day out. Because Khalil Gibran said it in The Prophet better than I could ever say it. Your children are not your children. They are the products of life's longing for itself. They come through you, but not for you.